Now, On Point with Stuart Kaplan and Chris Pi Hoda.
I am really excited about today's show. I have a guest that I have wanted to come on for a long, long time. And you got to stay tuned because I think you're going to really be interested in hearing about him and what he does. And just to give you a little insight, he's a retired FBI agent, 23 years, and he now is a detective with a local police department working cold cases. And when you hear about what he does and how he does it, it's just absolutely fascinating. And I think also we're going to talk about one of the most notorious cases in recent times, going back to 2007, when Nancy and Joey Bocchicchio in Boca Raton, Florida, at the Town Center Mall, were tragically murdered. And that crime, to this day, still has not resulted in the apprehension of any individual. And this guest is going to talk about his responsibilities as being the lead agent in that case. Chris is off today. He is traveling, so I'm flying solo. And so I want to get right into it. And the first thing I want to talk about is just the craziness that we've all witnessed unfold across the United States at these universities, in particular, Columbia University, Harvard University, NYU, out in California. I mean, you pick it. No place in the United States is immune to having anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian protest, pro-Hamas, and death to the United States, protesters, agitators, and actually these kids are setting up entrapment camps. They're what is unfolding is just unimaginable. But I think the question that I have and that I've been asking myself is, it's not unusual when we look back in history, certainly when we go back to the 1950s, and we know historically, certainly with a lot of protesting going on in connection with the Vietnam War, it just didn't seem like it seems playing out today. And I guess my interest is, how much is social media playing to kind of accelerate the flames in connection with the growing trend of anti-Israel protesting, pro-Hamas protesting, pro-Palestinian protesting, and just what we're seeing, violence and disruption at these most prestigious academic universities. And when you look back in particular at Columbia University, there is a history of protesting. And certainly, as I mentioned, in connection with the Vietnam War, it was not unusual. It was not unheard of. In fact, protesting was done at Columbia University, but it just didn't seem to have the same impact that it's having that it's having today in today's world. And it's paralyzing. It's closing university. It's threatening democracy. It's threatening the right for free speech. It's dividing all of us. And is it the fact that we all have access to social media? This is all being played out real time. And so the whole world is participating in this. Is that why it has become so accelerated? Or is the bigger issue or the question is, are these young people, is the indoctrination of open borders and allowing people to come into our country and having access to the academic institutions on the administration side, the teachers, the professors, and now the student body, are we seeing a byproduct of what these kids are learning in these most prestigious universities? I don't know. I don't have the right answer, but it's certainly very, very troubling for the way that it is playing out, because in my day, if I had an opportunity to attend Columbia University, Harvard University, any of these universities, Stanford universities, I mean, my God, what a gift, what a privilege, what an honor to have been afforded that opportunity to attend such a high academic institution. And quite frankly, as I raised two kids in my own household, I'm not so sure that if Columbia University came knocking on the door and said, hey, Stuart, we're willing to give your son a four-year ride whether or not I'd be so inclined to accept that. I'm troubled by what I see. By the way, do you guys remember in September of 2022, just a couple of years ago, almost 2 years ago, when Ron DeSantis, the governor of the state of Florida, funded from San Antonio, Texas, he paid for 50 illegal immigrants to be flown to Martha's Vineyard on Massachusetts coastline. And let me just stop. If the governor wants to pay to ship me up to Martha's Vineyard, governor, please send me my ticket. I'd be more than happy to spend my rest of my life on Martha's Vineyard because it is one of the most spectacular and beautiful places to be. I cannot believe that this is going on now. A lawyer was able to assemble almost 50 of these illegal immigrants and petition the Customs and Border Patrol, ICE, Immigration Service, and was able to obtain U visas for all of these illegals. What that means now to all of us is that ICE or the Immigration Homeland Security is treating these individuals as victims of crimes. And that was born out of a sheriff down in San Antonio. He was a sheriff, Javier Sanchez. And Javier Sanchez, who's a Democrat, not surprising, he opened up a criminal investigation and suggested that these illegals were exploited and were duped on getting on a plane to Martha's Vineyard. Now, I will tell you, if someone wants to dupe me and put me on a plane to Martha's Vineyard, I'm all for it because I'd be very happy to be there. Do you realize, ladies and gentlemen, that these illegal people that have violated federal law, who are in the country illegally because they did not follow the process, are now here on a visa? They're able to reside in the United States. They're allowed to work. And it is almost guaranteed that they will have their path to citizenship or at least legal residency in the United States. I think we're living in a crazy world. That is crazy, crazy town. I don't even know what to say about that. It just is ridiculous. But when I think how ridiculous and upside down the United States of America is, maybe it's not so crazy, because in London today, horses that are maintained by their army escaped the barracks, and you have horses running around. I can't make this up. You have horses running around the city of London, and people and horses are being treated for injuries. So when you just think the United States is upside down and crazy, maybe things are a little bit more crazy in London when you have horses running around and they're hurting people. And the horses themselves are obviously getting hurt themselves as well. But I just offered some levity just to talk about that. On a future show, I'm also going to bring up Dr. Larry Nassar. The Department of Justice, as a result of the FBI's malfeasance and just neglect, DOJ just settled that lawsuit. There were almost 150 victims that were sexually abused by Dr. Nassar. And keep in mind, he was a U.S. Gymnast doctor who treated these girls and abused these girls. And when the FBI was called to investigate the allegations, it fell totally on deaf ears. These girls were repeatedly abused. And obviously, eventually, someone woke up and paid attention. But unfortunately, way too late. And these girls, for the rest of their lives have been turned upside down. But at least there's some silver lining here with respect to them being compensated, even though that will never be enough to undo the trauma that has been done to them. And it squarely falls on the FBI for their neglect in going out and doing what they should have done and investigated the allegations. I want to introduce someone that I consider a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, someone who I worked with when I showed up in at the FBI in the Miami division in West Palm Beach. This agent was there. He was tasked with investigating violent crimes and major offenders. He ended up being one of the bank robbery coordinators and ended up investigating more than 500 violent crimes and was tasked with investigating some of the most dangerous criminals out there. And as I indicated at the beginning of the show, he was the lead case agent investigating the murder, double homicide of Joey Bocuccio, who was a 7-year-old child who was killed with her mother, Nancy, outside the town center mall. What's really interesting about this guest is not enough after 23 years with the FBI and retiring, he then decided to return to law enforcement, and he is now a detective with the Riviera Beach Police Department working exclusively cold cases. And in the last couple of weeks, he just cracked a case that was on the shelf for 10 years. It was a homicide in West Palm Beach, and we're going to talk about that. But without further ado, I want to introduce John McVeigh to the show. How are you, John?
Good. Thank you, Stuart. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure to have you. I got to tell you, I'm so excited to have you here. And you know, you and I, we had lunch not too long ago, and we were talking about, you know, some of your old cases, and then you were talking about your tenure now at Riviera Beach, and in particular with respect to DNA testing, and we were talking about the case that you just solved.
Right.
Tell us, first of all, you were with the FBI 23 years, correct?
Yes. And prior to that, I had 7 years at Jupiter Police Department.
So a lot of time in law enforcement.
And a lot of time in this county. I mean, almost 30 years here and just in this county.
Amazing. Amazing. Let's talk about the going back to December 12th of 2007. Do you remember getting a call, or where were you when you found out about this double homicide at the Town Center Mall?
Well, initially, I found out from everybody else where you saw it on the news. You know, they had a woman and a child that were found dead in the car in the mall parking lot. You know, the press wasn't really talking about anything. And at the time, you know, we really didn't have any investigation into the case. And it wasn't until shortly after that we were contacted by Boca Raton Police Department asking for assistance. And due to the fact that, you know, what they found out later was that basically she was carjacked. And somebody accosted her and her daughter, bound them up, and eventually shot them for some reason. So that gives the FBI at least jurisdiction to investigate, because carjacking is a federal crime.
Now, if I remember correctly, now Nancy Bocuccio, she was married at the time.
No, she was divorced.
Oh, she was divorced.
Yeah.
How much, and so thank you. Mm-hmm. How much time, or was there a period of time where there was any efforts to suspect that her ex or her ex-husband was responsible?
Yes. They, you know, initially the belief was that it was somebody from Miami who had committed the crime, because they found out that her cell phone was missing. And then they found that her credit card was used within 1 or 2 days at a gas station down in Miami. And so, you know, initially, you know, they checked for video surveillance and they had nothing. All they had was Nancy and Joey coming out of the mall and then basically disappearing. You know, we didn't know where they went, what they did. And so the police at the time figured, okay, well, it's somebody has a credit card and the driver's license and everything else. And they did a really good job. They went down, they tracked these people down, and they tracked it to a homeless person who basically said that he was walking in Northeast First Street, looks down, sees a credit card and a cell phone. And he basically sells the cell phone to somebody later, after he had been called numerous times by people. Because once Nancy was found, family members and relatives started calling her cell phone and he started answering. And people were like, you know, this woman was murdered. You have her cell phone. And he's like, well, I don't know anything about it. I found it. So, you know, their initial investigation, I think they thought was, okay, you know, we're going to go to Miami and the people that have this did it. And they clearly proved that they had nothing to do with it at all, that the suspect went down there and dumped it for whatever reason. There's a lot of speculation with the investigators originally that, you know, maybe they took it down there to throw us off the track, or, you know, whatever. And my feeling, and we'll get into it, my feeling is no, that it was dumped because he was either thinking it was hot or he just dumped it and got rid of it.
Gotcha. Now, was there any, now Boca Raton, I mean, Boca is a very prestigious area to live in. Did it shake the community? Was this front and center on every newspaper and on every TV show? Or did you get a sense that there was an effort, because the Town Center Mall is such a prestigious mall in itself, that there was an effort to maybe suppress it because they were concerned about the economic impact?
Well, I think they, you know, initially the press was all over it. You know, you have a mother and a young child murdered. Does those type of things happen in Boca? No. Has there been crimes in Boca? Yes. Has there been murders in Boca? Yes. So they're not immune. The Town Center malls had their ups and downs, where they had a guy back in the 90s that was stealing Rolex watches from people. He was eventually caught. But I think overall, you know, the mall clearly didn't want this. I mean, it's something that's, you know, people shop there, they go there, they feel safe. This was December 12th. It was 13 days before Christmas. You know, everybody was supposed to be happy. And, you know, it doesn't look good that, you know, you have this incident occur. But I think no matter what happened or what the Town Center Mall management could have done or didn't do, I don't think it was stoppable. I think that this person had a motive and did what they knew how to do and get away with it.
Now, in 2007, was there CCTV? I mean, was there any video surveillance on the mall property? Or was this at a time where we're not where we are today, where, you know, it's hard to walk anywhere without being captured on CCTV?
No, there was, but it was analog. You know, everything was VHS tapes. And the mall exterior had it. And there was a area at the mall between Sears and Nordstrom's where there was a walkway that you could lead into the mall. And that was videotaped. And you can see Joey and Nancy walking out. But then at some point, as they get to the parking lot, basically the video stops because they don't have any cameras out there. Now, on the Sears building, there was a loading dock that had cameras. And of course, the police went there and of course later found out that those cameras in the Sears were operated by the private investigator, security detectives, you know, that work the shoplifting.
Right.
And the only time they're recorded is when they go in and hit the record button.
Gotcha.
So at the time, you know, if they weren't following a shoplifter, they're not hitting record.
Gotcha.
But when you look at that, you know, you think a situation with her is it's 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's bright out. It's light out. For someone to come there and commit that homicide, and we don't know where it exactly occurred, but we know that the car was parked right there a few, you know, maybe 100 feet from the front door, that somebody got out of that car and you'd think they would look around and see something, and they see the camera and that they feel relaxed enough that they can just walk away, not knowing if it was being recorded or not.
Now, have you come up with a hypothesis or have you come up with a theory as to whether Nancy and her daughter were targeted, or was this just a random act? What do you believe the motive was for the person who did this?
I think they were clearly targeted.
For what reason?
Well, you have to go back because you have two prior incidences. There was an incident in March at the mall, but
same
not
year?
At the mall. Same year, 2007.
Okay.
So there was a lady named Randy Gornberg who was seen leaving the exact same door as Nancy and Joey. She disappeared. She was found about 5 miles away in Delray Beach. She had been shot and pushed out of her car. That was something that the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office was investigating. So fast forward in August of 2007, a similar incident happens to a woman and an infant who come out of the Saks at the Town Center Mall. They're accosted by a male who basically makes them drive to an ATM and withdraw money. And then he binds them up and brings them back to the mall. But this person had cooperated. She had, you know, done everything he said. And she was with him for almost 45 minutes in the car because he actually got lost after he was driving the car and he bound her. So you now have two incidents of people at the mall.
Now, the lady you mentioned, Gorman?
Gornberg.
Was she murdered?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And so at the time, you had the Boca Raton Police Department, you had the Sheriff's Office investigating both of these crimes. And fast forward to December, you now have Nancy, who again is accosted and is also actually taken to the same ATM bank, the Bank of America on the corner there, that the first girl and her infant was taken in August. All along, I'm believing, as I was getting into it, that this is a pattern. A lot of people disagreed with me. They thought it was totally different.
I mean, not related in any way.
Yeah, the Gorenberg one is not related. Wow. Everything. Okay. And look, I understand, you know, you have someone that's now committed three murders, and the last thing the Town Center Mall wants is a serial killer.
Sure.
Because then you're not going to have anybody come into your mall, okay? I don't know if it was more of one police agency not wanting to talk to the other one or vice versa or whatever it is. Eventually, I think in the last, you know, 10 years when we've put this thing together, I think we've come to the conclusion that these all three are related. And I think it was an escalation. I think the person who, I mean, look, you're stealing $500 from somebody from an ATM. Okay. Just like you said, it's an affluent neighborhood. There's people walking around with $20,000, $30,000 Rolexes. There's people in $100,000 cars. For me to steal $500, I just go up to some lady and you hold a gun and you take the money. But to go to the extreme of putting him in the car, driving him to an ATM, binding them up, and then whatever else you're doing, it's just, it's like something else out of, you know, some crime novel. And I think what it is I think this person knew that he can control women. And when he takes Randy Gorenberg, he controls her. Randy never withdrew any money out of the bank account, but she happened to be found about a half a mile from where her bank was.
So you think she resisted then?
She definitely resisted just from the crime scene. Okay. Gotcha. He kills her. Then we go to Jane Doe, which is our first one in Boca. Jane Doe cooperates. She's taken for $500 out of the bank. And basically they do the withdrawal. The guy gets the money, drives her around. He gets lost and finally comes back. And at the time he drops her off, she's bound. And he told her, like, look, I know you're going to call the police, but I have your driver's license. Don't tell anybody. But if you do call the police, tell them I'm a short, fat black man. Okay. Well, again, she immediately called the police once she got out of her bindings and told the story what happened. Fast forward to December. You have Nancy coming out of the same exit again, goes to the ATM, and seems accosted and taken to the ATM. And I think this is an escalation. I mean, my opinion is the first one, Randy Gorenberg resisted, okay, and he ended up killing her. I think he thought then, well, I need to find somebody that's got a kid that's not going to resist, so I'll hold the kid. So he picks Jane Doe with a two-year-old. Well, during the ride, the two-year-old's crying, he's upset, things like this. And I think that maybe at the time he thought, well, geez, I don't want a two-year-old. Let me get an older kid that we don't have to worry about giving a bottle and crying. And he picks Nancy and Joey, who is a seven-year-old girl who's not going to resist. He binds her up. And unfortunately, Nancy resisted and he ends up killing both of them. And he walks away.
What was the method of killing?
Shot.
I mean, you have to be a monster. I mean, listen, you have to be a monster to kill anybody, you know, for cold blood to kill someone, but to be able to kill a child, you're a monster. I got to ask you, and I know we're going to get to talking about DNA in your current position with the Riviera Beach Police Department. I would think there'd be a treasure trove of DNA, whether it's the first one, the second one, the third one. Is there not a lot of DNA that you have? Why is that?
It's not because it wasn't taken. Samples were taken. I mean, you know, we had close to 400 samples taken out of her car and we've got nothing. So, I mean, it's nothing that, you know, you basically look, you know, you and I could sit here and hold that pen and, you know, we could have somebody come swab it and not get anything. I mean, if you're not secretor, if you're not sweating, if you don't drop sweat on it, you don't drop blood on it. It's very difficult. Now there's DNA that Nancy and Joey was in the car and there's mixtures. But the problem is with DNA is science hasn't figured out how to separate the mixtures. You know, so if you and I both touch that pen and one of your producers touches the pen, they may come back and say, well, we know it's at least three people. It could be more, but we can't separate it. And that's I think, you know, that's like the Nobel Prize. I mean, if someone comes up with how to figure out you can separate it, you know, that's going to make a lot of cases in this country, but at this point you can't do it. And
now I'm curious then. So you have all these DNA samples that were collected, you said 400. Are they just sitting somewhere waiting to be retested, or are they in a system where if this unknown individual gets apprehended and gives a DNA sample, it will have like a hit on that, okay, these three murders or these four murders or whatever they are in Boca, boom, there he's related.
Not written, no.
So unless someone goes back and retests them or re-enters them?
No. So basically somebody, we would have to have a suspect to go back and test them compared to the mixtures. Because a lot of times in the mixtures, they're able to pull out a major profile and a minor profile. Or they're able to come out and say, well, the probability that it's you and me is one in, you know, whatever percentage they come out to. So when you have a mixture, when you have a mixture, you can't enter a mixture into the computer database that is called CODIS, because you can't do that, because you don't, the computer wouldn't know what it's searching because you've got the mixtures. So you need to find the suspect and then get a DNA sample and then test it against the ones that are there.
Gotcha. Now,
and that's hard because you got to find some other evidence to link him to it, where, you know, a lot of these cases you get DNA and, oh, you get a DNA hit and it comes back to some offender who's in jail and you've just solved the case.
Now, you retired in 2018
yes.
from the FBI.
Right.
Did you work that case up until the day you retired?
Yes.
And would it be fair to say, I know from our conversations, even after, it's still bothers you
one of those things that sticks with you? I still get calls from some of the detectives that are still around. They'll ask me on leads, or if they get a lead, like, do you remember this, or, you know, was this person interviewed? Just recently I've been notified on a couple of them. There's a show on Netflix called American Killer or something, I don't know what it's called, but there was a guy in California that kind of did the same thing where he tied the girl up and blindfolded her and put goggles on and things like that. But we had known about him and basically back then eliminated him because he wasn't in Florida at the time. But yeah, look, you can never get that picture out of your head of the crime scene photos and seeing her in there and knowing that a 7-year-old girl who should have been in school at the time. I mean, that's what the scary thing is that she was taken out to go to a doctor's appointment. I mean, if she'd had a doctor's appointment, we wouldn't be sitting here.
Do you believe sitting here today that those crimes will ever be solved, that someone will be held accountable?
I would love to say yes. I mean, I really hope so. I mean, I hope the technology advances. I hope there's someone out there that knows something, because look, people talk, you know, bad guys talk. I think the strangest thing about this case is that you had these three incidents in such a short period of time. And then basically nothing after. I mean, it's like he dropped off the face, he or she. I mean, we know it's a he right. at least, but there maybe is a co-defendant or right. something. Dropped off the face of the earth. You know, what did they do? I mean, did they just stop killing, or did they change their motive? I mean, what did they do? And that's what's the hard thing about it.
Now, did the FBI bring in, you know, a person from Quantico who does yes. a profile?
Oh, yeah.
And did they create a profile of who they think this person, the age, the sex,
yes.
What are they, you know?
So they came back. We believe that it was somebody that probably had some law enforcement, military, security guard history.
And why is that?
Due to the fact of using the type of handcuffs and flex cuffs to tie the person up. And after interviewing Jane Doe, the mannerisms that the person did, especially when, you know, handcuffing somebody, you know, you get them, spin them around.
Right.
And she basically described it as to what happened. And the first thing you're thinking in your head is, well, that's a cop. I mean, a cop does that. But it's at least somebody that has the ability, that knowledge of handcuffing and things like that. So, you know, we know it's a white male or possibly Hispanic, somewhere in the 30s. We know the person had a, you know, very baby face. There wasn't a lot of hair on the face, relatively tall, about 6 foot. But the composite that's always been shown, you have to remember, that's the composite from Jane Doe that happened in August. You know, due to the fact that, you know, Nancy and Joey aren't alive, we don't have a composite. We have no idea what the person looked like at the time.
How did the person get to the town center mall? Because from what you're describing, he would carjack them, right? He would get in their own car. You were getting the victim's car?
Yeah, but they were already at the mall. So he got to the mall either in his own vehicle or public transportation or whatever. but he's clearly sitting there waiting. And if you think about it, is, you know, we all go to the mall and you see people walking around. And if you're trying to target somebody, you have to figure out that probably 50 people that you target, maybe one of them's a good target, right, where you're going to follow them out and do what he did. You know, in Jane Doe's case, you know, she's got a kid in a stroller. She goes out to the parking lot. And the thing about this is that she puts her child in, and she had a big SUV. You know, we all go out and what do? We go doot doot, and you open up all the doors. She opens the door. She puts her child in the center seat, straps him in, closes the door, opens the hatch, puts her packages in, puts the stroller in, goes to her front door. And now we're talking, it's a Lincoln. So I think it was a Lincoln Navigator. I think it was. By the time she gets from putting her door down, in the hatch down in the back, opening the door to the driver's side, he's sitting in the seat.
In the passenger seat.
So he's in the rear next to the child.
He's already
in.
Wow, that's scary.
And you're talking a matter of seconds.
So he's waiting for you to be at the most vulnerable time.
Yeah. And if you think about that, I mean, look, just go to the mall and try to do that, you know, anywhere. The odds of getting to that perfect situation. I mean, how many people did he probably go up to and waited and it was too late, or right, or they clicked and locked the door or something like that? And then the other thing about this, if the child was in the rear passenger seat, he couldn't have got in because he would have had to jump over the kid.
Gotcha.
But due to the fact that the child was in the center, he just jumped into the back seat.
That's amazing. Not to put you on the hot seat, if you had gotten the call at the beginning, meaning at day one,
yeah,
do you think the FBI or your investigative skills, and with the FBI being brought in at the very inception, do you think the outcome of the case may have been different today? Meaning, were there any mistakes, or was, listen, Boca is a great police department. I know a lot of police officers that work there, and I have the highest regard for them. And they've grown as the population has grown.
Right.
But they're still a small, relatively small department. And of course, fortunately for Boca, they don't get a lot of violent crimes. And I tell people, you know, the level of your experience as being a detective is based upon your exposure of what you're used to investigating, right?
Right.
Do you think that there were some things that should have been done maybe, or could have been a little different, that may have resulted in a different outcome?
I think we'd still be at the spot we're at now. I don't think somebody would be in custody because the physical evidence isn't there. And the hardest homicides to solve are the stranger ones, because you have to figure out the connection. You know, a lot of times, you know, there's calls, domestics or whatever, or the wife's found dead and, you know, the husband goes golfing and it's pretty obvious who did it, right?
Right.
You know, there's an association. But when you have this total random, there's nothing showing that they have any connection whatsoever, and you have someone who basically is just picking people off, they're the hardest ones to solve, because if they don't leave the evidence, they don't leave the fingerprints. You know, this guy got lucky. I mean, you're talking about in Jane Doe, you got August, and you know, you think the person would be sweating, drip sweat somewhere, touch something. I mean, you know, he got lucky. And then the same thing with her situation. It's December. It was still warm at that time. You know, you're doing swabs, he sweated on, so he's gotta be upset. He's gotta be nervous. He's gotta be wondering around what's going on. There's not a sweat ball or skin, anything dropped. And he got lucky. And I don't think anything would have been different at this point.
Now, are these cases now similarly situated as what you're working now for Riviera Beach? Are they considered quote unquote cold cases?
From what I'm doing now?
Yeah. In other words, in Boca, these unsolved crimes, have they been now designated as cold cases?
Well, I mean, cold, it's everybody's definition of cold. I mean, you know,
no
cold
one is working them every
day. I mean, cold could be 30 minutes away, right?
Gotcha.
You know, so
gotcha.
I think it's this stigma that people have now that cold is 20 years ago, 30, 40 years ago. and really, in essence, is anything, my feeling, anything after a year is could be cold. And, you know, Boca, I know, is still working in, and I know there's somebody that took over my investigation in the bureau that's still doing stuff because I get calls from them. Right. Hey, what about this person? Or, hey, do you remember this? And, you know, I usually tell them what I remembered.
What about the families? I mean, they must be still devastated.
They are. I mean, we did last summer, I did John Walsh's show, and we had Joanne Bruno, who is the sister. You know, she still is devastated. It's
did
just
that
horrible.
Help at all? Did anything come out and nothing of
no.
any value?
No.
That's interesting. So that's a perfect segue into now you're working with the Riviera Police Department as a detective, correct?
Yeah, I'm not certified. So basically it's, you know, I'm a liaison detective, if you want to call it, right?
Listen,
yeah.
But you're investigating cold cases.
Yes, yeah.
And those include unsolved what?
Unsolved homicides only at this
All
point.
Right. Let's talk about recently. There was a case in, mm-hmm. in the news recently where a unsolved murder was solved, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Talk about that.
It was a 2014 case. It was one of the first ones we looked at. It was a man who owned a tire store. Basically, he was out there changing tires. It was in Riviera Beach. There was an employee with him who was a teenager, 19. And these two guys out driving around looking to rob people, they had committed two crimes prior in West Palm Beach where they shot two Hispanic males just for no reason at all, just went out and robbed them and then did another crime. They're driving around. They carjack this person. They take the guy's car and they're proceeding to drive around. And on that night, it was 8 o'clock at night. It was dark. They pull up, they get out and they just start shooting. And, you know, the man and the employee are trying to run for it. They all get hit. They run up. They grab some jewelry from them, get back in the car and drive off.
And the case remained unsolved for 10 years.
Right? Yeah. Look, there was a lot of evidence. The detectives did a really good job at the time, but there was some controversy as to prosecution. I mean, look, is there probable cause? Yeah. Is there beyond a reasonable doubt? It was difficult at the time because they just didn't have enough to get over that hump.
So had a suspect or suspects been identified back early on, or was it more recently?
No, it was early on. Okay. But then again, you come back as like the physical evidence has to link them there.
Gotcha.
You know, the car was stolen. They did their fingerprints and stuff in the car. Nothing was found. And so we went back and I realized that some of the weapons, these guys were, and it was like a dual investigation because you had West Palm Beach Police Department investigating them on their two crimes. And then Riviera had the homicide, but they weren't married up together. And it was only until after West Palm used the Marshal Service to find these guys to arrest them that they started putting two and two together. They found the stolen car that matched the one at the scene. The weapons that they found in the car when they test fired them back then, they end up finding out that there was a match. So you got a hit on the cartridge casings that were found at the scene. So unbeknownst to me, I mean, things weren't processed. I mean, there was some things that we needed to process again on the guns. The technology's advanced. So we went back and we had the sheriff's office lab do some more testing. And lo and behold, we ended up getting the DNA hits or the comparison because we had the suspects on both of the guns. But then again, we had witnesses at the time that needed to be re-interviewed. So we traveled to North Carolina to interview a witness. We interviewed some other people around because, look, even though you might have that evidence at the time, you still need witnesses. You still have to believe you're always going to go to trial. And so, you know, you need to find out, are they on board? You know, are those people going to testify to what they told the police back then, which is hard. And even if you can find them sometimes you can't even find them.
Now, was DNA testing critical in resolving that case?
Oh, definitely.
I guess if I'm understanding, the science had advanced itself to the point now where you could do things that you couldn't have done
yes.
many years ago.
Correct.
Right? And so that's obviously, and as we continue down that track, it's the science is getting better and better and better.
Yeah, and they're able now to make some determinations with the mixtures where they're basically saying that the probability that it's you and some unknown person in the whole wide world is this amount. So back, you know, back then, I mean, you're only talking 10 years ago. I mean, usually you had to have a one source, you know, fingerprint, right. Or, you know, basically a swab that would identify the person. If you had any mixtures, the results were, we have a mixture, we can't identify anybody.
Gotcha. How many cold cases do you now have,
John? A lot.
A lot. Okay.
Over 100.
All right. So that's a lot.
We had homicide cases back to 1955, but my first unsolved is 1965.
So I want to bring this up because it, when you and I had lunch a couple of weeks ago, we got into this discussion, it completely floored me and it bothered me to the point where like, I couldn't put it to rest, and I couldn't put it to rest because the way I was trying to compartmentalize is I have a lot of my friend neighbors who are very involved in, you know, saving the earth or mm-hmm. saving the green earth or,
right.
you know, saving, you know, animals, and they give a boatload of money to all these good causes. And I get all that. But when you told me and you said, Stuart, one of the major hurdles that I have working these cold cases is not for a lack of wanting or having DNA samples. We don't have the funding to send off the DNA samples. Meaning if you have a DNA sample right now that potentially could identify an individual who would ultimately be the responsible party for killing that person,
right.
there is a deficiency of the funding that it would cost. How much does it cost to test DNA?
Well, it's very expensive. And, you know, there's a few labs in the country that are doing this. You know, the local sheriff's office here in Palm Beach County has one of the best laboratories in the country, but they're overwhelmed. I mean, not just homicides. You think of the amount of DNA samples that are given to them every day from the 37 or so agencies in this county that they're trying to work. It's overwhelming. So basically their policy now is that they're not going to process some of these older cases. You're going to have to send them out and have a private lab do them. And, you know, it's not like, you know, all you think about it, you just have a swab and you test it. You put some chemicals on it or whatever they do, hocus pocus, to come up with it. And it's not that easy.
All right. But when you say, is it $500? Is it $5,000?
So I'll give you an example. So I have a case right now from 1995. It was a woman in Riviera Beach who had been raped and murdered. And I have a towel. And we had the tips of the towels tested because we believe the suspect had touched them. Just the tips of the towels cost $12,000 to be swabbed and analyzed and come up with results.
So it's a very expensive proposition.
Yes. I mean, and these private companies know they, you know, look.
Well, they're in to make money.
They're right? in to make money. Okay. And I understand that. But you have agencies that, you know, when they come out, when they do their budget, nobody thinks, well, we need DNA testing, you know, things like that.
I want to put you on the spot then. You said you have a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Are there any cases right now that you know, if you had the funding to pull those cases off the shelf and get the testing, if you had the funding, could you solve any of those cases?
Yes.
And it is because of the lack of funding.
Yes.
I mean, John, how do we fix that? How do we, I mean, I listen, and by the way, when I left you, mm-hmm. and I went back to the office, and you know the people that I'm talking mm-hmm. to, and you knew who was at lunch, right? It bothered me to the point, first of all, you know, living in this community, mm-hmm. you know, it's one of the wealthiest communities in the United States. I break it down that I don't think there's enough public awareness. I think that the general public assumes that police departments have adequate funding or whatever funding is necessary to do DNA forensic testing. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody knows that DNA funding is a serious issue and that there's a serious lack of funding to be able to help and assist and solve these crimes. And the way I look at it, quite frankly, John, is if you have a cold case that you're telling me, Stuart, if I had the funding, I could identify and apprehend an individual who's responsible for a murder. And by the way, you know, murder is the worst thing anybody mm-hmm. can do, right? If that murderer is still amongst us, not only obviously has he killed whoever he killed, but he's likely to repeat and murder again or has murdered again. And so that's a threat to all of us. And so there would be an urgency, an exigency that there should be no lack of DNA mm-hmm. funding, especially when someone like you, who has such an incredible vast experience in this, that you should have as much resources as you need. And if it's just money to get DNA testing, and it's more likely than not to solve those cases, what's the rebuttal
right.
to that?
Right. So I think, like you said, what is it? I think it's the education, not of the police departments, but of the governments, right? You know, after this case that we just solved this, we've had the opportunity with the city manager. They're allotting us money now. I've actually found a group called Season of Justice, that literally I went online and I applied, and it's a grant that they're giving us. Now, there's grants out there, but you have to apply to them. And, you know, there's Department of Justice grants, and they only give out so many a year. There's other agencies, and this Season of Justice that we applied to was on this 95 case because we realized we need additional testing. And when we got a quote on the additional testing, it was $18,000. So luckily, this company basically is, we went through a process, their board of directors granted us the money, and we're going to do it, which is great. But I think it's the education of, you know, you have towns, you have city managers, you have council people, commissioners and things like that, that don't see this. They don't know it. They just hear, hey, they need, you know, $200,000 for funding for DNA. And they're like, well, what do you mean 200? That's ridiculous. Why would, whatever it is. But when you start seeing the successes and you start seeing the ability to help victims' relatives get through it.
And I understand I'm looking at it from the perspective of, you got rapists and murderers that are still out there, and it's only because of your lack of funding. They're raping and murdering all day long, right?
Course.
And so,
of course,
what more do I need to say than that is the absolute most important priority for that police department, that we're going to get you whatever funding you need, because I know out of 10%, 15%, mm-hmm. whatever it is, it doesn't matter. One guy off the street who commits murders, that makes everybody that much safer.
Of course.
What... I got to be honest with you, John, it drives me nuts. I never knew this before. And I hope that, you know, the audience is just as surprised as I was, because to me, money is the easiest thing, right? You can always find money. Right. And when, you know, and I'm joking about, you know, people saving the world. Mm-hmm. What greater cause is there? If you really want to save humanity, save, you know, the victims and the victims' families who have been so harmed by such violence.
Right.
And we can put these bad people away because they're living amongst us. And that's what erodes these communities that, you know, are, you know, living garbage. And listen, you know, the people that live in these neighborhoods, and I always say 99% of them are people that get up in the morning.
Yeah.
They mind their own business. They get in the cars and they go to work and then they come home and they just want to live in peace.
Right.
Unfortunately, they live amongst bad people, some bad people who hang out, sell drugs, murder people, gang violence, all that. And then you're just, you're trying to navigate that. If we can get rid of those people, then these people can leave their homes, open their windows. They don't have to have 20 locks on their doors. And I just am astonished that it's because of the lack of DNA funding.
And I think, like you said, I think it's the education of those people that are in charge of the money. You know, we always knew in the FBI, like, you know, you got so much money, you had to spend it that year.
Yep.
And they're just spending on anything. And I think, you know, when you look at it, some of these cities who, you know, at the end of the year, they're spending money, or you're finding out that there's a piece of art that cost $500,000 on somebody's lawn. You're thinking to yourself, well, geez, like, couldn't we have used that for this? But I think it's the knowledge, because people don't realize.
No, but John,
just think, okay, I'm gonna send the evidence off to the lab. They're gonna send us back the results, and everything's fine. We don't have to pay for it. But you just can't. You can't go to PBSO and say, hey, we're gonna give you 100 and some cases of DNA swabs. They're like, well, you know how long it's going to take? I mean, it's just insane.
But what do you tell a loved one? What do you tell a family member or friend?
I know.
That says, hey, detective, you know, how come you're not doing DNA? How come you didn't test the DNA?
I know.
Could you with a straight face say, I'm sorry, we don't have the money?
I mean, unfortunately, on some of those, I have to. You know, it's just like, I mean, that's why it's like the ability to find the grants, the ability to get some of the cases. And again, like the funding, I mean, if you give me $100,000, I could go through that in probably 4 or 5 cases. If logically there was enough pieces of evidence.
Understood. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to give to the most important cause in all of our lives that affects each and every one of us, listen, get in touch with John McVeigh. He's with the Riviera Beach Police Department, or get in touch with me, because I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to build this bridge, because there should not, never, ever be a lack of funding in connection with DNA testing, especially when I know, you know, it is the absolute link between taking a case that's sitting on a shelf collecting dust that's going unsolved, and it could be the difference between solving a case, and not only solving a case, getting a bad guy, a right. bad person off the street and putting right. him where they belong and putting him in jail. John, I'm going to bring you back because you are an incredible guest.
Thank
I
you.
Really,
pleasure.
Listen, the pleasure is mine. You are fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to bring him back. I just a wealth of information, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks for watching. On Point with Stuart Kaplan and Chris Pie Hoda.